On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we say goodbye and thank you to the 2025 Toronto Blue Jays alongside Sportsnet's own Ben Nicholson-Smith. We giggle and dissect the Colorado Rockies hiring Jonah Hill as their director of baseball operations. The Padres have a new skipper. And then we bring back so gleefully the good, the bad, the ugly, including a $10 million toilet made of gold. The offseason begins in earnest. Here we go. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world still talking about the 2025 Toronto Blue Jays. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman, and that statement is definitively not true, and we are ecstatic to be joined off the top today by one Mr. Ben Nicholson-Smith. Hello, Ben.
Guys, great to be here. I enjoy talking baseball with you pretty much throughout the entire month of October, so I consider this just my Barbacast fix to get to talk to you guys and follow up on the conversations we've been having.
This is your slow detox out of hanging yes. out. For all of October. Ben, before we continue, who are you? What do you do?
Well, I write about baseball for Sportsnet and Sportsnet.ca. A lot of that is about the Toronto Blue Jays, most of that, especially lately. So, really dialed in on the Jays, their World Series run, and what's next for this team. So that's me.
So, Ben, it is so good to have you here. And before we start off our Blue Jays conversation, I think it's relevant. You mentioned we've been spending a lot of time with you, but it is very relevant kind of when that started during the course of the month, because I think that really informs how special and maybe unlikely and in some ways surprising this run was. And so before we say any more, let's do it. It is our opener. It is the Toronto Blue Jays.
The Los Angeles Dodgers won the World Series. And yet, somehow, this month that has since passed belonged to the Toronto Blue Jays. They are the defining team of that month. That is both because of how unexpected possibly that run was. It is because of how dominant that run was from an offensive perspective. It is how both of their seven-game series went the distance and how every nook and cranny was packed with drama, the roster packed with characters, a country learning to fall in love with baseball again. And so on this episode, we thought it was prudent, nay, we thought it was obligatory to give the 2025 Toronto Blue Jays one final shining moment in the audio sun. And so we will begin, Mr. Ben Nicholson-Smith, with a very simple question. When did you believe this was possible? At what point during the regular season did you look around in the clubhouse and look around at the two other reporters that were in there by you and say, in 4 months, this room is going to be packed and full of tears after World Series Game 7?
Never did I anticipate that it would get to the point that it got in so many ways. I mean, they played better. They were a more compelling team. They had more support for each other behind the scenes and more kind of humor and ability to connect with one another and the fan base than I ever would have guessed. And maybe this is like a really bad reflection on me as a reporter, because in theory, I should be like noticing these things before anyone else. But I can't honestly say that in July, I was like, yep, World Series team. No one else sees it. I've got this figured out. I would be lying if I said that. I think that by when they swept the Yankees on the Canada Day weekend, right around July 1st, that was a big moment for the Jays, because that point, you're midway through the season, you're in first place, you got a real shot. But when I say a real shot, I mean, you know, to win the division, to go on a playoff run after losing 88 games the previous year. So it probably took until mid-September, by the time it seemed like they were going to clinch the AL East, that I was like, all right, hey, you clinch the East, you get a first round bye, anything could happen. But mid-September, I mean, that's kind of an embarrassingly late answer on my part, guys.
No, but I think it's totally valid. And even mid-September was not late enough to know for sure that they were going to win the division, which is amazing and speaks to, of course, you know, the Yankees had that softer schedule in September. And, you know, we were waiting to see, okay, are they actually going to pull this off? But we talk about the regular season, and I've talked to your colleague Shai Davidi about this, kind of the low points earlier in the season when they, you know, they get swept by the Rays, and like it's like, oh, this really is going sideways. And then of course that you mentioned that series against the Yankees, the momentous mop. It was four full games, and then not just a sweep at the beginning of July, which is very important. But let's zoom all the way into October. Because I think beating the Yankees, of course, felt like beating the Yankees again, we should say, because they spend the whole regular season essentially chasing them down and then fending them off. But I referenced earlier, you know, when we saw you, because I guess Jake saw you during the DS in New York and then also for the first two games of the CS. But for me, I see you for the first time when the Blue Jays are down 2-0. Heading to Seattle. So I see you ahead of game three in Seattle, and it's like, oh, this is not looking awesome. And then Julio Rodriguez
after
homers off Shane Bieber, and I'm like, this team's cooked.
After game two, I never think I'm seeing Ben again in the rest of my life.
Exactly. You know what I mean? For a year, it's like, oh, well, it was fun hanging out with Ben for a week here, and that was it.
Great couple days.
Instead, yeah. We just couldn't get rid of you because the Blue Jays kept on winning. So let's zoom in on October. Was there a moment in October, I assume it was at some point during the Seattle series in 3 and 4, when they just whooped them, you know, I mean, they really put it on them those two games before what happened in game 5. Was it still even later where you were like, no, this team's really got a chance to go all the way?
Honestly, for October, I would say it was a little earlier, where it's like as soon as they get the bye, because as soon as you get the bye, you can set things up a little bit better. You're going to be in just an advantageous position, depending on how the wild card series went, and did go 3 games. So the Yankees at that point are just a little bit more worn out. You have the advantage. So I think that was the first point that I thought this could really happen. Then they go down to 0-2 against the Mariners. I was thinking the same thing as you guys. Well, I mean, to pull back the curtain a little bit, myself, Shai, we would have been doing World Series coverage regardless, but I thought it might be like in Philly or something, you know, at that point. Like, it was not anticipating that it would be in Toronto, which was a really cool experience, but not what I was expecting. So I think, you know, at a certain point in the run, you realize, okay, Vladdy's locked in. That's big. That was a massive thing. You also realize, okay, Treya Savage starts to go from this unknown into, oh, is he like a number two starter? You know, like he's striking out 11 Yankees and 12 Dodgers. Like, this guy can make a difference. So that starts to shift your perception of the team. And then you just kind of realize these guys really like each other. They're like really funny. They have a great time together. And that nudges them a tiny bit even further ahead.
Ernie Clement can't get out.
It helps.
well, and that's the other thing is, and you joke about the things that you maybe didn't notice throughout the regular season, but a lot of these players were of course involved. Yeah. Savage is his own category. Obviously, he was not involved for any of it. But a lot of these other pieces we saw have success along the way, whether it was a Barger, whether it was a Kirk or Clement. Like, these guys had good seasons, and then it all seemed to really come together. I mean, literally everyone was essentially playing their best at the same time, and you found enough other outs on the mound, because the big question entering October was, this team has the highest ERA of any postseason team.
So,
and at points along the way, that did come back to bite them, but also enough of them were performing better to where it was like, no, this team's legit.
Yeah, no, I think that's what they had to do from a pitching standpoint. And you think about some of the biggest questions that they had pitching-wise going into October. Jeff Hoffman, like, did not have a strong finish to the regular season. And unfortunately for the Blue Jays, did not have a strong finish to the postseason either. But in between there was a period of time where he was dominant. And really, for the full month of October, you know, he set aside the unfortunate sequencing at the very end, but he was a very, very good pitcher in October and helped them get as far as they did. So, yeah, I think that they ended up being able to piece things together a lot better than anticipated, where you have Eric Lauer performing close to peak abilities. You have, you know, Jose Berríos goes down. no problem. Chris Bassett's all of a sudden like a late inning relief option. John Schneider's pulling the right strings. So they were able to make it work on the pitching side with, you know, some very good defense to help them out.
You know, I look back on what I thought and said about the Blue Jays during the season and how I did not believe this team could make a deep postseason run, something that I admittedly, in retrospect, was incorrect about. And the thing that I did not believe in was the pitching. I was impressed by how this kind of the second level of offensive players, Barger, Clement, Davis Schneider, like how that group was contributing. But you look at the rotation, it's like, even heading into the year, Gossman I believe in, Barrios I didn't believe in, Scherzer I didn't believe in. I was like, okay, so who's your number three starter? And then like we wake up on October 9th and it's Shane Bieber and Trey Savage. Is there anything that we can learn about what happened here to the Jays pitching as we try and evaluate teams moving forward? And how they may look in April versus how they'll end up looking in September.
And I think you can throw the Dodgers in that too, because their pitching would have looked so different in April than it did in October when it counted the most. And I think in the Dodgers' case, that was by design. In the Blue Jays' case, there's no design that would have said, yes, we're going to, you know, have Shane Bieber. I mean, Shane Bieber and Trey Savage, like, good luck doing that with your draft picks every year. Obviously, credit to the Jays. That ended up being a really good pick, you know, I think we can say pretty safely. So, yeah, what we can learn from this, I've been asking myself that same question that you just asked, Jake, and, like, trying to figure out what we can take away. I think that, you know, I look at the idea of depth and flexibility and the fact that, on the pitching side, you're going to have to make it up as you go along. There's no way, like now as we begin the offseason, there's no way in this offseason for the Blue Jays or any contending team to acquire all the pitching they need. You're going to have to bolster your team in July. Every contender has to. So I think accepting that there's going to be a certain amount of unpredictability of shopping that you have to do in July, you're going to have to part ways with prospects to get it done. And that's worth doing in pursuit of that balanced pitching staff. So I think that on the pitching side, you just have to kind of make it up as you go to a certain extent. But on the position player side, I do think that the Blue Jays had more depth than myself or a lot of people gave them credit for. And then that in tandem with a couple really impactful stars gives them enough to go deep into October.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that with the pitching too, the point about the deadline is certainly accurate. But I think as we saw across the league, Savage is an extreme case. But Cam Schlittler, right? Peyton Tolley, you know, and Connelly Early, like these teams. And if you look at the Dodgers also, like they, you know, revived Roki from the dead, essentially, to be able to have him be extremely important. You know, these are internal pieces that you have to find ways to use on the mound by the end of the season. And clearly teams are more willing to trust the kids and say, screw it. Like these are our best options, even if they've barely thrown any innings at the big league level. And for the most part, that carried teams. I think that you have to be able to do all of that. I agree to get the necessary innings that you need.
And just the fact that Savage did this, still mind-blowing, by the way. I'm still making sense of this. So might take, like, honestly months before I'm like, what happened? What did I just watch?
Well, and it's as simple as opening his Baseball Reference page and not seeing anything. It's like, you pull it up, you're like, oh, let me check out Trey Savage. It's like, hold on, I got to click a couple extra things to see what I really want to see.
Because he's pitched more in the postseason than he has in the regular season.
By almost double. It's like he's almost got to that point. So,
kid a nap.
Yeah, I mean, he is. And it was just watching him take it all in was a fascinating experience, too. And like seeing his reaction. I know Ben and I were both in the clubhouse post game seven, and that could honestly be its own podcast. Like, we both obviously wrote stories off of that scene there. I think you and people like Keegan really, really harped more on the scene, and understandably so. I mean, there were so many little moments from that post-game scene that will stick with me for a long time.
Stuck with you, Ben?
we could do some of that just because we saw some of the same stuff. So yeah, go ahead there.
Yeah. What stuck with me was just the fact that these guys were crying and you know, it wasn't just one player. Like for Ernie Clement and Chris Bassett, you know, Max Scherzer on the brink of tears. This is not, you guys have been in clubhouses lots of times at the final day of a season, whether it's regular season, postseason, it's never a happy place. There's no good way to lose a World Series, but I don't know. Like, that to me was like an extreme, just as far as the despair and the devastation, but also just like the genuine sadness that these guys weren't going to be able to continue in this kind of vibe that they'd created and really enjoyed. And so that really sticks with me. I mean, they played well. I think on the field, there are tons of moments that we'll remember, you know, Vladdy, Springer, Yesavage, and so on. But really that off the field of just like the devastation in that room was pretty palpable, as I know you felt, Jordan.
Yeah. And I think that leads me to kind of my next big picture question. And then we want to certainly spin forward, because the Jays remain a main character in Major League Baseball now. I think that there's a lot of reason to expect that to be the case this winter and next season and beyond. But before we do that, I want to talk about John Schneider a little bit, because this is a manager and a character that I think we all got to know a little bit better, a lot better, I would say, this postseason, in a way that most national media certainly had no really experience with him, other than his few high-profile missteps in their three previous very brief postseason runs, right?
Or and whether the time it was all- that he bullied the roster into getting rid of the jacket.
Well, okay, well, I'm glad you mentioned that too. And so and there's a lot of elements to this question, so you could take it wherever you want, but it's just like, I'm curious, as someone who has covered him the whole time and I'm sure was aware of him before he was even the manager, and his story is amazing. He has only been a Blue Jay, right? He was drafted by them over 20 years ago. He played for them. He's coached for them. He managed at basically every level, I think, and, you know, managed Bo and Vlad in the minors and all these things. And now he's managing the Blue Jays for the World Series. And so, you know, I got a glimpse, and I've gotten to talk to John a handful of times over the past couple of years and sort of get a little sense as to his personality and stuff. But this was a whole different thing. I mean, this is a guy going in front of national media every day for weeks. That's a totally different spotlight. Right. And I think gaining a lot of respect and admiration. But from your perspective, as someone who's seen it from the beginning and has seen some of his missteps along the way, some that he has very openly reflected on, I'm curious what you make of the John Schneider glow up per se, and what has surprised you or what you've kind of taken from that.
He is glowing. He's a very shiny man.
By the end, he was. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I have covered John Schneider for a long time, even, you know, going back to when he was a minor league manager and a coach with the Jays. And I think over time, he has just adapted to the demands of being a Major League Baseball manager better. And I think it's an ongoing process where, you know, he'll tell you it's still an evolution. But I just think that he needed reps. And when the Blue Jays got swept in two games in 22 or in two games in 23, then you don't really get the reps, and the reps that you do get are like borderline traumatic for your organization, because like it goes horribly and they lose. And then people, of course, rightfully and understandably, fix onto that. And then that's like how you're defined. Now that he's gotten a lot more reps, it's not like he managed perfectly necessarily. I mean, probably you look at the Brendan Little example in Seattle and you look at the Brendan Little usage after that, he didn't see any leverage. So clearly they decided, you know what, in hindsight, that's not exactly how we'd want to do things, but no one manages perfectly in October. It's a month, right? You're not going to expect perfection out of anyone in your organization for a month. So he's allowed to make mistakes too. He clearly made a lot of good decisions to get the Blue Jays to this point. And I think, setting aside the tactical, you know, X's and O's of the job, he seemed to embrace, you know, what it meant to be a spokesperson for the organization, yeah, spokesperson for the players in that room, and have their back. And that was his most important thing, was having the players back. Seemed to work. So there's a lot that goes into it, as you guys know, but he seemed to gain comfort as the postseason went on.
And the strategic side doesn't come right away. Like, think about how much time we spent criticizing Dave Roberts as a tactician, right, for years. And then he just unleashes a borderline flawless October, right? That stuff takes time and it takes reps and it takes practice. And I have to say, I was just generally struck by how at ease Schneider felt with handling the public side of this, of being the spokesperson. He never at any point really seemed overwhelmed by it. Before we kind of spin it forward as it pertains to the Jays. I want to ask about baseball in Canada, because it seemed to me that the whole country was tuned in effectively, and the TV numbers reflect that. And, you know, I'm around my wife's extended family all week, many of whom are Canadian, and they all want to talk about the Jays. None of them have ever wanted to talk about the Jays with me before. And like, my question is, what does this mean for the sport going forward? Right? Was this a blip? Was this an aberration where a country cared about beating America at something? Or is this a sustainable growth in popularity for a sport that is already, you know, extremely popular in Canada? But do you think that this has a positive, lasting impact? And in 25 years, when, you know, three of the best 20 players in the big leagues are Canadian, like, we look back and say, yeah, these guys grew up watching, you know, Ernie Clement in 2025.
Yeah, I hope there's an element of that. As someone who, you know, lives here and is Canadian and loves to see the sport thriving here, I would love if three of the top 20 players are Canadian, you know, in 10 years, in 20 years. Yeah, I don't think it was a Canada versus USA thing from the standpoint of people here. Like, if the Blue Jays had been playing the Mexico City team, it would have been just as intense. If they were playing the Tokyo Giants, it would have been just as intense. Like, it's really just about, I think, seeing the Blue Jays succeed.
Okay.
And just following a team that, you know, captured people's imaginations too, because it's kind of the beauty of low expectations, where to an extent, this season will never be replicated. It could be surpassed. Obviously, if they win the World Series, it's better than making it to Game 7. But it can't be replicated, because you enter with low expectations. You have this group that seems to gel so well. You have these stars who emerge as the season continues. Like, hey, here's August. It's time for Shane Bieber. It's September. It's time for Trey Savage. And then, yeah, I think that the element of surprise and the way that this team liked each other and connected with each other, it's going to be tough to replicate. So I do think that this sparked something, but it's always been there. And it's 10 years ago for 2015, the bat flip, it was there and you saw it kind of surge up, and it's there and it'll surge up again. Yeah. But it's cool to see. It really is.
I like the idea that you're right. It's like, Ernie Clement, can you believe this? And then, like, if he does it again, it's like, yeah, Ernie Clement, that's just what he does, right?
but
that's it.
I think that's a good way to spin it forward to the last part of this conversation, which is what happens next. Because I think that the way we were, it's completely fair to say what the expectations were coming into the year, because they finished in last, because there seemed to be huge flaws on the roster and flaws in the roster that we didn't know how they were going to be addressed until they were, right? But now it's a different conversation for a lot of reasons. One, because you did just come that close to winning the World Series. And also because people are like, wait a minute, like, they have the fifth highest payroll and they have Vlad Jr. on a $500 million contract. And like, as we've seen the last 2 years, they are going to be active in free agency. And when they're active in free agency this time, it's not going to be like, oh, ha, the ball, look at the little Blue Jays doing their best. It's going to be like, well, yeah, duh, of course. They just went to Game 7 of the World Series and they have a ton of money. And so now, as we shifted forward, I'm sure they're still going to be underestimated no matter what happens this offseason. And going into next year, there will still be people like, nah, Blue Jays aren't going to do that again. And maybe some of that will be fair and some of it won't be. We'll see how much we fall victim to doing that. But it is a different conversation now. And you just had, you know, did the postmortem with Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins. And I know a lot of that was also just about reflecting.
Ross, how would you evaluate the season, Ross? Yeah. Ross, you have a good year, Ross?
A little bit of a different conversation and then dive in headfirst into the offseason. But there are obviously some huge questions that the Blue Jays face this winter as well. So we definitely want to zoom in on Bo here in a second. But before we get to Bo, like, is that a fair characterization that now just the way you expect that both locally in Toronto, the way you're talking about the Blue Jays, and even nationally, because you have that perspective as well, the conversation, I think, is fair to say, will probably shift a fair bit about what we're expecting from them in the offseason and in the actual season?
Yeah, one would think so after going to the World Series. I think that another big thing that changed is they actually signed Vladdy. So to have him, $500 million, you know, there was this whole, I don't want to say narrative because it was also connected to reality, but there was the set of circumstances where the Blue Jays had pursued a lot of major free agents like Juan Soto and Shohei Ohtani, and they had gone elsewhere. So then Vlad Jr. to sign for $500 million, choosing Toronto, great. Shane Bieber opts in, chooses Toronto, great. So to me, you know, they go to the World Series. Like, that narrative is kind of flipped, I would think, where it's like, all right, clearly some players want to play in Texas, great, good for them. Some players want to play in Toronto, good for them. So, you know, I'm just laughing at Jake's reaction.
I choose Toronto.
So there we go.
If it was up to us,
I'd rather live there.
Yeah.
So, easy, you know, Texas. I think that from that standpoint, the Jays have, and they just have fewer needs too, because they have Vladdy locked up. So now it's like, add an infielder, add a starting pitcher, add some bullpen help, they'll be good to go. Now, we might still see those reports nationally where it's like, the Blue Jays are on tilt. The Blue Jays are going to desperate to do something big. And like, make no mistake, they are going to be open to doing something big. So like, if you see them linked to Murakami, yep, they have interest. If you see them linked to Ranger Suarez, pretty sure they're not going to not look at Ranger Suarez, you know? So they do have interest in these top players. They could probably use a starting pitcher who has a little control beyond 2026. So it might be a good idea to look at Suarez and Cease and Fromber and see what they can do there. But I don't think there has to be this undertone of desperation. Not that within that front office they ever felt desperate, but the perception was that they should be desperate or they were desperate. And I would think that perception starts to shift this offseason.
And I think, you know, of course, the irony is, you know, some of the guys they did land didn't exactly fuel them to the World Series, whether it's, you know, a Santander or, I mean, Scherzer's a weird one because he was obviously a virtual nothing in the regular season, but shows up shockingly helpful in the postseason. But anyway, all of which is to say, yes, we could zoom in on the specific needs. But I think we need to finish with Bo. I mean, the Bieber conversation is interesting, but...
One more quick thing.
I want to make sure we go heavy on Bo here before we wrap.
I just think it's important to understand, like, they have a pretty significant amount of money coming off the books. I just did a back of the napkin
after next edition year. After next year.
No, I'm saying after next year, but even after this year. Just right now, it's $70 million, right? $70 million. And that's Bo, Dominguez, Bassett, Scherzer, IKF is being paid $7.5 million. Like, there is room here for them to do things. Now, obviously, they have to backfill some of those roles, but the Blue Jays should be acting like we talked about this in the last episode. It's not Goliath versus David. It's Goliath versus Samson or a different biblical figure of sorts.
Someone that also is not as small and you know, low payroll. Dinky. So, but again, next year, it's even more so when we're talking about long-term commitments, like now we're talking about Springer's in the last year of his deal. Gossman's in the last year of his deal, right? Bieber now is, you know, has the one more year. So all of which is to say, the Blue Jays have money. They have money. They had money before regardless of what their payroll already was, we knew that they could spend, but how they spend it is going to be interesting. And Bo Bichette is the headliner for obvious reasons. And I think my read on this situation is Bo wants to be there. Bo is, because he's extremely young for a free agent and has this offensive track record, is probably going to be considered at a number that maybe the Blue Jays are not comfortable with. But the key here is what position he's playing. Because my sense is if Bo Bichette is cool to play second base, that the Blue Jays would be happy to have him play second base for a lot of money, but maybe not the highest contract that he would get. But if another team says, Bo Bichette, you're a franchise shortstop, here's $50 million more dollars than the Blue Jays are willing to give you, that's where it becomes more difficult. That's my read. Where do you sense that the Blue Jays are at with Bo and where you kind of view them as going forward?
Well, I think as with so many free agent kind of odysseys, this one could take a while. And like, maybe it'll end next week and we'll have closure pretty quickly. But so often these things drag into January and there's so many twists and turns. So as you guys know, it's hard to anticipate where it all goes. What I can say for now is Bo Bichette has consistently said he wants to return to Toronto and wants to win a World Series with Vlad Jr. and the rest of his team. And that's something he kept repeating until a few days ago. So I'm going to take him at face value there. then the Blue Jays themselves say, yes, we have interest in Bo Bichette. We really love what he offers. We're going to continue this conversation. They obviously qualified him, which he's expected to decline in another week or so. So that's a starting point. But as you said, I mean, there's so many variables here. Like if, I don't know, like the Rockies under DePodesta decide that Bo Bichette's their guy. And I'm not, you know, for argument's sake.
I mean, hell yeah, guys.
then, you know, they offer him 225. You know, they kind of like, you know, the Xander Bogaerts, who's kind of maybe in some ways a comp for Bo. Hey, I don't think someone was necessarily up at 275 against the Padres 280. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if someone goes out there and blows Bo Bichette and his agency out of the water, then at that point, it might just be over. But if things are close, I think the Blue Jays will be there. And honestly, I don't know, guys, like which direction it's going to go, because in free agency, anything can happen.
I will say that, at least in my bad, irrelevant opinion, my perception of Bo Bichette altered because of what he did in the World Series. That he is a player whose skills and ability can overcome the randomness of the sport more often than others. That he, in the moment, rises to it. Even though he could barely walk, right? Like what he was able to do in the World Series, I understand it's a small sample, but that's how you win playoff games, is with guys who are just simply better. They are just better. And Bo is better. He is that type of naturally talented main character that teams should be trying to keep and acquire.
I agree with that take. I agree. I think that he really is a special hitter and has been his whole career when it comes to just putting the bat on the ball. And yeah, he runs high BABIPs, but I think there's a big skill element there to what he's doing. And like, he's doing that in game 7 of the World Series on one leg against Shohei Ohtani. It wasn't against, you know, with all due respect, it wasn't against Adrian Hauser on May 15th.
Whoa!
Like this is,
but
you know,
it, but
not
it's
to be...
also against Adrian Hauser on May 15th.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. This guy hits nonstop. He's always hit. So, you know, he's a great hitter. He's going to make someone's lineup so much better next year. Yeah. And you know what? On one leg, he actually looked pretty decent at second base. So, you know, there is some defensive value there too.
I'm gonna say something that's like jumping ahead. We haven't obviously done our full free agency preview, but it's something I've been thinking a lot about with like Kyle Tucker. Because when you're at this level of free agency, and we'll end on this, like ownership's involved. And you kind of need something that like sells, right? You need something that like the rich people are going to get really excited about.
Kyle Tucker doesn't
do that. Like he's got everything on the version of just like baseball stats and just like projection.
Not a billboard
like,
guy.
He's got all of that handled. Bo, it's a little bit more mixed. And yet Bo's someone you can imagine an owner being like, oh yeah, no, give that dude all the money. Like that guy is awesome. And so whether that ends up being the Blue Jays or not, you can understand why they would be exactly who that would be, because they know exactly who he is and what he's about. But that would be my fear if I am a Blue Jays fan desperate for Bo to return, is that you can imagine someone else like tripping over themselves to give him all the money. Even
like some other owner was watching game 7 and was like, that was cool.
100%.
Yeah.
100%.
No, I think that's valid. And it's kind of funny because as you guys know, having covered Bo as well in the last month, but you know, he's not someone who needs to be the center of attention, to put it lightly. You know, like he will answer the questions, but he's not trying to be in the spotlight. He's not trying to take up tons of attention. I don't think he needs to be a guy who's on the side of a stadium. I mean, obviously he will be wherever he signs, but I don't think that's, he's there to play baseball. He wants to win. I don't think other stuff is really
but
what's driving
him. But he's comfortable with it. Like there are guys like Tucker, even, you know, like Will Smith kind of, where it's like they are checking these boxes and it is, they just, Anthony Rendon, right? They just want to show up and not talk to you. Bo is not that. Bo moves easy through the day when we watch him. And I think that he will handle whatever those responsibilities are whenever they're put upon his shoulders.
Yeah, I think that's a good take. Because like even to quickly pull back the curtain, like I covered him for whatever it was, 7 years in the major leagues. I don't think there was ever a time that he said, no, I can't talk. Don't want to talk to you. I think every single time I approached him, he was like, yep. But so often the answers would be like, feel pretty good at the plate, you know, like pretty short answers.
Right, right.
And it's like, yeah, just put a good swing on it.
But he,
you know,
it's
like okay.
You did. You sure did, Bo. You put many yeah. as good swings on it. But no, it's true. And I think it's an important distinction that like, it's the comfort of being maybe not the center of attention, but also, again, he grew up in big league clubhouses. He understands the responsibilities of it. But my point more so was just like the player, what you're watching on TV in between the lines in the box yeah. is breathtaking, is a very special talent that I think could win over a lot of teams. So anyway,
my last question before we kick you out, Ben, very swiftly. How did this October change your relationship with baseball and covering it?
Ooh, man. It was really fun. It was really fun. And baseball is like always fun for me, or like it, I try to, I mean, that's one of the things that you guys do so well, seriously, is just like connecting to how fun baseball is. But I think baseball was really fun in a way that, you know, in Bradenton on like March the 6th, like is, you know, hopefully there's a little bit of fun there, but the World Series run was really fun. And honestly, it was really cool to see so many people just in this community to what we were talking about earlier, just caring about baseball, because that's what we care about all the time, right? So to see other people pulled in to that extent was probably my favorite part about it.
Yeah.
Well, Ben,
yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us, for taking the time. Thank you for all your coverage all season long on the Toronto Blue Jays. Where can people read your work and watch you nod on television?
Well, for anyone in Canada, you can find me on Sportsnet for the TV part of things. For anyone else, sportsnet.ca is where I will be writing about the Jays
and other stuff, because Ben knows ball and beyond stuff. He's very capable of continuing on this
baseball podcast,
and we will I would not be surprised if he joins us again on Baseball Barbercast this winter. But for now, Ben, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll do this again soon, my friend.
Thanks, guys. Talk soon.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. The year is 2001, and we need to talk about Moneyball. The Colorado Rockies have a new head of baseball operations, and his name is Paul D. Podesta. Now, this is incredible for a million and one reasons. Jordan Schusterman, let's give some context before we say why. The Rockies, for the last decade, have been baseball's most aimless and archaic and regressive franchise. I think that is pretty comfortably true. They are behind the times. They are insular. They are America in the 1930s, not interacting with the rest of the baseball world. And as a result, they have racked up more than enough losses. At the end of this season, their big baseball man, Bill Schmidt, we'll say stepped aside or was encouraged to do so. Such left a void at the top of their baseball operations tree. A search was thus conducted, interviewing some of the brightest names in the sport. Two names kind of moved to the top of that list: Matt Forman, who is a big honcho over in Cleveland, and Amael Sade, who is in Arizona. Those two gentlemen said thank you, but no thank you, or removed themselves from the mix due to what appeared to be disagreements over ideological direction. And then a couple days ago, we get the juiciest bomb of the century, Paul D. Podesta, the new man in charge of baseball operations. Now, what is Paul D. Podesta from? He comes from the Cleveland Browns, one of the NFL's most successful teams, famously. But what is he famous from, Paul D. Podesta? Moneyball. Jonah Hill's character in Moneyball is based off of Paul D. Podesta. Based off of seems kind of underselling it. It's Paul D. Podesta under a different name. Jordan Schusterman, when you heard this news, what did you think?
So this is just an astonishing thing to place to land for so many reasons. I am going to laugh at something that was definitely not intended, but again, it kind of gets at the point I want to make. On MLB trade rumors today, they have, like we have, you know, we have our opener. They also have an opener where they, you know, every day that's like, all right, what's going on in baseball? And the first subhead is Rockies get their man, which is a great turn of phrase that is used often in sports when it's like a team is going after a player or a coach or whatever, and they got their man. But this is such a preposterous way to phrase this. Again, I don't mean to harp too much on the specific use of it, but it's just so funny because this was clearly at no point plan A. They did go about a process where they canvassed current Major League Baseball executives who are considered at the top of their field. We have speculated, you have mentioned many times on the show, as we've talked about the Rockies over the course of their catastrophic season where they lost 119 games, we said that like this is a job, if Rockies ownership is willing to open up their heart to new ideas, that smart baseball people are intrigued by, that they would love the challenge of taking on what it means to succeed in Colorado and all that entails. Like that was an intellectually stimulating possibility that smart baseball people wanted to pursue. That is why when they started interviewing these candidates that we were like, okay, it seemed like they were heading towards that solution.
However,
and then we ended up,
what have we learned?
Not there.
We have learned that the intellectual exercise of winning in Colorado, intriguing it may be, does not supersede the startling and humbling reality of having to work with the owners of the Colorado Rockies to try and accomplish that goal. That is my biggest takeaway here.
Yes. Now, and that's before we even get to like the choice of hiring Paul DePodesta. By the way, gloss right over the rumor that they were talking to noted YouTuber Adam Ottavino and former Rockies pitcher, also about this position.
Great guy,
fascinating for
smart
100 other
dude.
Oh, yeah,
not qualified.
Yeah, but okay. So then let's talk about the concept of qualified, and let's talk about Paul DePodesta's qualifications, right? Because yes, he was indeed a main character in the Moneyball, not just the Moneyball movement, literally the Moneyball ace, right? Working with Billy Bean. He then goes on to run the Dodgers for a brief period of time. This man, who is clearly an accomplished and well-seasoned executive in multiple sports, has not worked in baseball for over a decade. And that is the great irony, the great just hilarious sequence of events where the Colorado Rockies have decided to now hire someone who is, I'm sure, a smart individual, but is now tasked with, ironically, the guy who's like associated with being ahead of the curve. It is now going to be on Paul DePodesta to catch up to where baseball is and has baseball has gotten since he left baseball in 2016, during which he has had not a whole lot of success with the Cleveland Browns. But I don't care about that because that's not our job to evaluate what he has done. I mean, it certainly doesn't help from a PR standpoint if you're trying to explain to Rockies fans why this guy is
in. I want to harp on the Browns. I want to get into the Browns for a second. Okay.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
He made the leap from baseball to the Browns because the Browns were like, he can help us. The smart mind can help us because he knows numbers and wow, he's using these numbers. Guess what? Everyone's using numbers now. Everyone's got numbies, right? People are using them. And I think that if Paul DePodesta had turned the Browns into some sort of modern football juggernaut, I would be more willing to believe that he could do the same with the Rockies, even though he hasn't worked in baseball. Instead, if we're accepting that I understand that like the Cleveland Browns are a bigger problem than Paul DePodesta, right? However, he could not save this thing. He could not fix this thing.
No.
And he was there for 10 years. He was there for 10 years.
Yeah.
And they sucked basically the whole time.
Yeah.
I think they made the playoffs twice during that span. And not only that, Jordan, he oversaw one of the most glaring awful moves in recent NFL history was to trade for Deshaun Watson and extend him. That was like Paul DePodesta. Okay. That's true. Is not, if Sam Presti, the general manager of the Oklahoma City Thunder, generally considered to be like the best NBA GM or top executive, took over the Rockies, I would be excited, I would be intrigued, and I would be hopeful. I am certainly excited and intrigued about this, but more from like a car accident situation than from a Paul D. Podesta is going to figure this out.
100%. And I think, again, if you compare it to the seasoned baseball people, the rising executives that we're considering, that we're interviewing, and clearly based on at some point in their conversation with Rockies ownership decided, this is not a path I want to go down because I'm not going to be able to do what I want to do, whether it's going to work or not. Like, as we know, this Rockies change, it, like, so much change is needed internally that it is going to require someone that understands what is missing. Maybe that's a good way to put it, right?
Yeah.
And for Paul D. Podesta, there's really no way for him to know what is missing, because if he's going to come in and be like, oh, we need to do, I mean, think about how much baseball has changed since 2016, right? I mean, think about how much baseball has changed since 2021, you know? And so
Paul D. Podesta is like, we got to trade for James Shields.
Right. And so that's the thing is sure, maybe he's been spectating baseball from afar and obviously has the baseball background. That is what's so amazing, that they could hire someone that, of course, was once considered revolutionary or ahead of the curve and is now tasked with. Now, I guess I still trust Paul D. Podesta to do it better than literally anybody involved in Colorado, because what is still, I guess, most important is that it is someone that has not been there. Right.
That's important.
We keep mentioning the word insular. So he will at least have the perspective of not having been with the Rockies, but that there's going to be still so much else to figure out just because he hasn't been in baseball for a decade. That is what is so like tough to, you know, we just talked about Tony Vitello. This guy's never been in pro ball. He's going to have to make this jump. But Tony Vitello, I'm confident, has a better sense of just what baseball is in 2025 and 2026 than Paul D. Podesta is and where it's kind of going. And so
now,
that is what is so concerning here. But also,
last point,
I'm fascinated. From a content standpoint, the guy's got pod in his name. We're going to be podding about this guy nonstop, no matter how good or bad the Rockies are. And
Paul D.
For that, I am thankful. For that, I'm thankful. Because honestly, if they had hired a Matt Forman or an Amiel Sade, I would have been excited. Like, look, they got this smart guy that's going to go try and fix this. It would have taken years. And it really would have been a lot of stuff that we wouldn't have even necessarily seen. Like, it would have just been a very slow build. They would have talked about process. They would have been like, we're going to work on our infrastructure and we're going to, and like all the buzzwords. And it would have felt more like any other rebuild. Now, again, it would have been more dramatic and it would have still been significant. This, I have no idea what to expect when he gets in there, who he's going to hire, who's going to manage this team, who wants to then go manage for Paul D. Podesta. Like, what is his network? Is he just going to hire someone he knew in baseball 10, 15 years ago? Probably, right?
What about
that
Art
seems
Howe?
More likely than yeah, right. So that is what I am from a content standpoint, hell yeah, let's do it.
That's the thing.
But if you're a Rockies fan, I just don't know why you can be feeling good about this.
I've oscillated between those two things. I want Rockies fans to be happy, but I also never want the Rockies to change, right? It is more interesting if we have this one team that just thinks it's unlocked the sport and then wins 50 games every year, you know? Like, that is funnier to me, even though it may be painful for the Rockies fans. The last point I'll make, and the reason why this is so funny, is because here's what it feels like. It feels like the Rockies leadership group, humbled by the disaster of a 2025 season, said, we need change. We need to modernize. And then in their minds, they were like, you know what was modern? You know what pushed the envelope? The guy from Moneyball. That'll do it. That'll fix it all. And they went out and got him. Now, I understand that that is a little bit less... It's not exactly how it went, I'm sure. But boy, does it kind of feel like that's the way it went, especially in the context of maybe you were going to bring this up later. It seems like the Rockies claimed a guy on waivers because some dude emailed the owner and told him to. Did you see this?
Yes. Yeah, so I think we've mentioned this on the show before, but you can just email Dick Monfort and he'll probably respond to you. I know this sounds absurd, but there have been multiple documented cases of Rockies fans emailing the owner of the Rockies, who I guess his email is available, and just like about the team. You could just be like, hey, what's going on with this random quad A outfielder? Hey, we should give this a try. Or, hey, the Dodgers are too good. And Dick Monfort will just respond to basically anybody with just like these brief emails of being like, yeah, you're right. The Dodgers are out of control. Or like, yeah, you know, I think we are going to let this outfielder, you know, try center field for a little bit. Like, and that is a reminder of, well, one, that it's just like unthinkable, bizarre behavior that he would tell. And on one hand, it's like, well, that's awesome. Look at this. This owner is staying connected with the fans. Like, that's great. And there's like a kernel of truth to that. But it's also a reminder that like this guy is, he really is involved all the time. And this latest example that you're referencing is someone posted that they, again, this is like a name that I can't even believe. Like, have you even heard of this person before? Garrett Acton?
The pitcher?
Yeah. Yeah.
Garrett Acton? Okay.
So
pitcher?
basically someone tweeted, emailed Dick Monfort and said like, hey, you should claim Garrett Acton on waivers. This guy who I'm not even sure if he's pitched in the big leagues yet, but like struck out a bunch of guys in AAA. And the Rockies just claimed Garrett Acton on waivers like the next day.
And the reason why you have to believe it's connected is that they don't have anybody pulling the strings right now on baseball operations decisions. And so you would think that any of the moves that they're making, it's like, who's making these moves? Maybe the owner. And the emailers.
Anyway, so again, there's just like things happening here that you just cannot fathom. But that is the real tragedy. And you talk to people who have had connections with the Rockies. And is that Dick Monfort loves the Rockies. He wants the Rockies to be good so badly.
So bad.
And yet this is how he's going about doing it. All of which is to say, I can't believe this. I can believe that Paul D. Podesta was like, you know what? This ain't such a bad way to leave the Browns. I can understand why he was like, sure, yeah, all right. I don't know. You want me to do this? All right, great. Let's give it a shot. I'll go move to Denver and try this. I'm sure he also thinks that this is challenging in the way that, well, I'm sure when he went to the Browns, he was like, oh boy, who can save the Browns? Well, evidently not Paul D. Podesta, but I'm sure he thinks maybe he could save the Rockies, and that's fun.
I just learned that the Patriots are 7-2 and that the Browns are 2-6. Let's move on from Paul D. Podcasta to Craig Stammen. Craig Stammen, who will be the new manager of the San Diego Padres. This is something of a shocking outcome for a variety of reasons. For Jake Mintz and Jordan Schusterman, two kids who grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, it is unbelievably funny that Craig Stammen and Kurt Suzuki are both major league managers now. It feels like a bit that we would have done when we started podcasting in like 2013, but it is real. It is very truthful. Craig Stammen, who after being with the Nationals spent a long time pitching in San Diego, I believe.
Six years, both
for the Navy Padres and then briefly for the Brown and Yellow Padres. He spent 7 years in Washington, 6 years in San Diego, a very impressive long big league reliever career with a 3.66 ERA across 885 innings, 562 games. Everybody who has ever talked to Craig Stammen seems to love Craig Stammen. That seems like his most important qualification here is that he's an incredibly likable guy. And compared to Mike Schilt, the previous manager, who was many things around the Padres, an extremely likable guy, maybe not the first phrase I'd use to describe Mike Schilt during his time with the Padres. This is definitely a zag. It is out of left field. And I think the most interesting thing that we have learned about the process is that Craig Stammen was involved in the interview process and was just so unenthused by the options that he threw his own hat in the ring.
Yes. And I don't know if that's exactly how it came about, but yeah,
not,
I mean,
how it
Craig
happened.
Stammen, not how it happened. Reportedly, this is from Alden Gonzalez at ESPN. Craig Stammen, who's been a special assistant for the Padres for the last two seasons, was part of the first round of like vetting dozens of candidates when they were trying to kind of trim down to who they were really going to interview. And he was like on the Zoom calls, like, all right, asking the questions. And then it seems like at some point after that first round, Craig Stammen was like, actually, I kind of want to give this a go. And at which point, none of us found out that he was one of the finalists interviewing, because we were hearing about Albert Pujols and Ryan Flaherty and Ruben Niebla and a couple other guys. But apparently he got in that mix, and here he is. Here's your new Padres manager, which
I like
is really,
that he
really
crushed
remarkable.
The interview. He crushed the interview and he interviewed himself. He's like,
well, he knew the questions that were coming. He knew the questions.
He knew the test. He knew the exam.
So clearly he's made a strong impression on not just Padres leadership and ownership and front office, but also they believe like this is a dude that was on the team in 2022, yeah. Which is not, you know, there's not that many players that were on the team in 2022, but it's a good number. It's a good number that are still there. This is interesting to us because of just a managerial subplot that we talk about often, which is that there are no pitchers who are managers. And now we have one again. When Bud Black was fired last year, we were left with zero active managers who are former pitchers. Now Craig Stammen will carry the legacy of pitchers managing forward, and we'll see how it goes. I think I am also intrigued as to, by the way, the Alden has reported that Ruben Niebla, who is the esteemed pitching coach for San Diego, is expected to stay in that role, which is a big win because he's considered one of the best in the business. So he's not going anywhere. But yeah, and for Pujols to whiff seemingly three times, you know, interviewing for the Angels, interviewing for the Orioles, interviewing for the Padres, I don't know when we're going to have a lot of, I don't know if we're going to have a lot of jobs open. Well, I can't imagine we're going to have nine jobs open again anytime soon, but it is very interesting to me what this means for Albert's future as a manager, because clearly he was ready to do it. And clearly teams were not ready to give him that opportunity. So we move Albert to the side and we'll see when we hear from him again in the future.
He's but doing for, okay. For he's still Stammen, making a I mean, mil.
He's fine. That's true. Still making a million from the Angels and still, you know, he's still Albert Pujols. But I will say for Craig Stammen, who seems like an awesome dude, Ohio guy from a tiny town in Western Ohio that I've driven through and can't believe that anybody came from there or became a major league manager. This is not a low pressure job. Like the Padres are still one of the like highest stakes jobs we have in baseball. And for Craig Stammen to get that position is pretty interesting. So that is, you know, as Jeff Passan tweeted, is this more shocking than Tony Vitello? I don't think so, but it is still, it is still compelling. And I look forward to seeing how this goes and to finding out how nice Craig Stammen is. It's also something I'm looking forward to as he, you know, makes the rounds as a manager who's talking into microphones all the time.
Oh, he's from part of the area of Ohio where the town names are just big cities that in other places. So he seems to be from Versailles, Ohio, which is near Russia, Ohio.
No, you walked right into that, Jake.
Do they call it Versailles? Do they say Versailles?
They sure do.
Oh,
they sure do. They sure do. Yep.
The Hall of Mirrors in the Palace of Versailles.
Yes, he is from Versailles, Ohio, a very, very, very small town. Maybe I'll go pay a visit to Craig Stammen's high school over the holidays.
They got to put him on the water tower, baby.
State. Maybe he does. I don't know. Do they have a sign outside? Again, I've driven through Versailles. I don't know if they have a sign. It's like home of Craig's Padres manager, Craig Stammen. I'll report back in December. Anyway, boots Craig Stammen, congratulations. And as I mentioned, we now have all the managerial jobs filled except for the Rockies. So that will be another round of news that we will get to when we get to it. We are going to take a break. When we return, we're going to talk about some qualifying offers and the return. Oh, boy. The long-awaited return of the good, the bad, the ugly. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbershop.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We will do the good, the bad, the ugly. We will bring it back in a moment. But before we do that, we have some little news nuggets to get to. Let's go around the league. All right. So let's do qualifying offers first. So for those uninitiated with this process, at the end of the regular season, at the end of the postseason, players that are becoming free agents, whose contracts are up, can be extended a qualifying offer by the team that previously employed them. This qualifying offer is a one-year deal with a number that rises slightly with the economic wins and inflation each year. I believe this year it is around $22.5 million. Jordan probably has that number at the top of his head. But usually how it goes is the big players who are obviously not going to take these deals are extended them so that if the team that had these players before loses these players in free agency, they get a draft pick as compensation. This is relevant for a number of reasons. The biggest one is that if you have the qualifying offer compensation attached to you and you are signed by a different team, the team that signs you then loses a draft pick. This is not a big deal for the big free agents, like whoever signs Kyle Tucker is going to be fine losing a draft pick. It will often hamper the markets of the like middle tier free agents. For instance, Nick Pivetta last year, his market, it took a while to kind of actualize because whoever signed him was going to give up a pick. I would say maybe one guy on average per year ends up accepting the qualifying offer. And I think that we do have two main candidates for this season. There were 13 players that were extended the offer. I'm just going to fly through them very quickly here. Here are the guys who are definitely not going to take it. Kyle Tucker, Kyle Schwarber, Bo Bichette, Framber Valdez, Dylan Cease, Ranger Suarez, Edwin Diaz, Zach Gallen, Michael King, and Trent Grisham. Brandon Woodruff was extended. I think there is a small chance he takes it, but I would expect him to go to free agency. And then the two players who I think could and probably will take it are Shota Imanaga of the Cubs and Gleyber Torres of the Tigers. It should be said that each player can only receive the qualifying offer once in their career. That is why players such as Alex Bregman and Pete Alonso are not on this list. If you are traded halfway through the season, you also are not eligible to receive the qualifying offer. So that is that's the deal. That is all I have to say about the qualifying offer. Anything else maybe on Imanaga or Torres specifically, Jordan?
No, I think Imanaga is an important one because, you know, we talked about the Cubs declining that 3-year, $57 million option that they essentially had for that they could have accepted or extended him. And the way I talked about that was like, oh, this might be the end of him as a Cub. But this makes a lot more sense that they basically, and it still could be, he still could decide to decline this and go on. But this makes much more sense from a process standpoint of, we would rather, like, we do want Shota Imanaga at, we would happily have him at $22 million for 1 year, not for 3 years with the way that he's trending. That makes a lot more sense now seeing the bigger picture. But he could still reject this and get, I do believe he could get, sure. Now, I don't think he's going to get $22 million AAV on a multi-year deal, but I think he could still get more than this. So this will be an interesting coin flip for him. But I could also imagine if he loves being a Cub and is happy there and will make $22 million and will re-enter the market next year, I could see him taking it for sure. Glaber's an interesting one. You know, he finished the year having hernia surgery, where I don't think he's expected to miss any time to start next year. But that was clearly a thing that hurt him for the second half. How much does he want to stay with Detroit? A Detroit team that like is pretty much ready to give Kevin McGonigal the keys at some point next year anyway. And so this is another one that like I am curious how much they're counting on him taking this versus not taking this. So that is definitely one of the things. I don't think Woodruff will take it, but we'll see. We'll see. So for the most part, these guys will reject it and they will move on. We will see if it impacts there. I could see Grisham's market being impacted too by this also. I could see that maybe lingering into later into the offseason. All right.
Let's move on to a fun little nugget that we got like 10 minutes ago. Jeff Passan of ESPN reporting in all caps breaking. Then Munetaka Murakami.
We should track this. We should see how many we get all winter. This is our first all caps breaking from Jeff Passan. All caps breaking. Japanese star third baseman Munetaka Murakami will be posted today, officially starting the process of one of the most anticipated free agencies of the winter. Sources tell ESPN Murakami's 45-day negotiating window to come to a deal with an MLB team starts tomorrow. That is why this is important. That is why the timing of this is relevant. And that is why this is breaking news. Because when Japanese players are posted and they are not full free agents, there is a window. This was true for Sasaki as well last year. But I guess not for Yamamoto, if I recall.
Yes, for Yamamoto.
Yes, for Yamamoto.
There's always a 45-day window.
Yeah. Right, right. So if you are, I guess there are players that are older, like Sugano. I don't think I know. But anyway, the 45-day window is important because we know that Murakami, if he's coming to MLB, has to sign by, I think, according to Mark Feinsand with the dates, December 22nd. So that's a big deal because we can't say that about Kyle Tucker or about Bo Bichette or about Alex Bregman, where they have to sign. You know, people say, oh, there should be a deadline for free agents so that they have to sign by this time. So here we're not just waiting until spring training. Here you go. This is these cases. You will have that. We will know where Murakami is signing by December 22nd. And that is exciting and interesting and will certainly be a significant one. If you're wondering who the hell is Murakami, we're going to talk more about him and his free agency when we get to our big free agency preview in a couple of weeks. All right. Let's have some fun. This will be quick because it's Friday and we have already said a lot of words on this podcast. But hey, we're only doing two pods a week, so we'll go a little long. Let's do it, Jake. It's time for the good, the bad, the ugly.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. One thing good, one thing bad, and one thing Dan Ugla-esque from the week that was in baseball. What is ugly? Something different, something odd, something out of the ordinary. Jordan, I will start this week with my good. It is an article from the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle. Are you familiar with their work?
Not in my news outlet rotation. So tell me, what are they reporting on?
So I'm spending a lot of time this week around my wife's extended family. She has a set of cousins who live in Rochester who went to Brighton High School. You know, one of her cousins lives out in Rochester still. And I said, how are things in Rochester? And he said to me, everyone wants to talk about Ernie Clement. Ernie Clement, the pride of Brighton High School from Rochester, New York, has apparently become something of an icon in Rochester as he is the first Rochester area human to like appear in a World Series since the 70s or something.
Oh, okay. Since the 70s. I was going to say, like, there were definitely people
back in
from
the
Rochester.
Day, it was,
yeah. Okay,
but like in a long time, which is understandable,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
It's upstate New York is a tough place to become good at baseball for a variety of reasons. And so I was like, it's really that big of a deal? He's like, go to the Democrat and Chronicle and check it out. And so I did. I go to the Democrat and Chronicle, and I find this article from one Mr. Ryan Miller, and here's the headline. Blue Jays' Ernie Clement spends day after World Series watching Bills at Rochester Pub. Amazing. There are photos of Ernie Clement at the pub watching his beloved Bills with some local kids who recognized him. The kids are interviewed. He signed baseballs. And like, the World Series is great for a million reasons, and it is a great reminder that the people who participate in the World Series, when they go home, if they still live in where they're from, are icons. Because the people who went to high school, like my wife's cousins, are like, yeah, I played field hockey with Ernie Clement's little sister. Like, there are so many lives that these people touch, and it was just a very cool reminder to see that Ernie Clement going to the bar to watch the Bills got a headline in the local paper.
That is so outstanding. I am looking at the baseball reference page for the 1,282 major leaguers to have been born in the state of New York. And it looks like a few dozen of them were indeed born in Rochester, including Mr. Clement. The most notable other one here is one Hall of Famer by the name of Old Hoss Radbourne, who I don't know how much he grew up in Rochester. I don't think he went to Brighton High School, but Rochester baseball is now going to have to look into some Rochester
on the
baseball
map.
History. Love that. Love Ernie. My good this week is the hiring and introduction of one Craig Albernaz, the newest skipper.
Craig Albernaz.
Your Baltimore Orioles. This is very simple. Craig Albernaz has the best New England accent that we have really seen. Not Boston. I mean, it is, you will still come across as Boston to many. But Craig Albernaz, who, again, I got to spend some time around as he was the bench coach in Cleveland the last couple of years with his pal Stephen Vogt, who was at the introductory press earlier this week. There's just no one. There's no one else in baseball that sounds like Craig Albernaz. And so
Fall River.
I'm not gonna do my best version of what Craig Albernaz sounds like. But I am so glad that he is now going to be talking into microphones. I keep saying this about these new managers, whether it's Tony Vitello, like, oh, what's he going to say? I just love that we are going to be hearing Craig, because when you're the bench coach, you know, he's not doing the scrum. He's not like, they'll talk to him on the side and you'll hear a little bit here and there. This is just awesome. And by the way, his family just seems absolutely lovely, and his interactions with the kids and just all of it, everything about it is tremendous. So I'm so excited for Albie, and just to have him be a character that Baltimore gets,
my
to,
character.
Gets to love.
Mark McGuire. I love Mark McGuire.
Ivan Rutt.
Yeah. He just seems like a bit character in the town. Yeah. He's going to be out there being like, Gunnar Henderson.
He's gonna coach him up. And I cannot wait. So that is my good. Congratulations to the Albernazes.
Alberni. You know what's bad, though?
Yeah. What?
Justin Dean is already on the Giants. Did you not see this?
Oh, I didn't, actually. I know there was a million waiver claims yesterday, and I somehow did not keep up with all of them. He's gone?
Justin Dean,
oh, no.
The man who did not pull the ball out of the wall, the man who finished in center field, okay? For the final out of the World Series, less than a week ago, Justin Dean was claimed on waivers yesterday by the San Francisco Giants. So
why? What do they need?
He was outrighted. He was outrighted by the Dodgers, and the Giants scooped him up. And it just feels very quick. It just feels, I understand the offseason waits for no one, but it's just odd that Justin Dean is just like already on the Giants. It's very,
you know,
weird.
What this was, Buster Posey begrudgingly watching the World Series, watching game six. He's like, that dude knows the rules. I need him.
He knows the rules. Rules guy.
Oh man.
That's so, I don't
awesome.
Know. It's just too soon.
That does feel a little fast. Because, you know, like the guys,
just like
there
Justin
are big
Dean.
Dodgers. Well, like, you know, the guys that are technically free agents now, whether it's Kike or Rojas or whatever, like, they're still doing all of the Dodgers celebrations, and they're like joking about being free agents and not being on the team anymore. But this is tough. this is really, really bizarre. Yeah. It does feel a little bit fast, but it'd be kind of cool because it means that like Justin Dean is wanted. You know, I kind of like that.
Of course he's wanted.
But Anyway, happy.
It's funny that Justin Dean.
But that is weird.
Justin Dean, whose whole bit, like, be like, yeah, he can really go get it. The most famous moment of his baseball career will be him not going and getting it. Actively not getting it.
Perfectly said.
Leaving
no
it.
No notes. It'll on, be him on leaving that point. It. Very well said. My bad this week is something that I would not normally go out of my way to acknowledge. I am often annoyed when us in the baseball space get essentially rage baited by people who don't normally talk about baseball weighing in on baseball. Normally, I'm very quick to just move past it and not care because it's like, why does this person's opinion matter? In this case, I'm not going to do that. So, Jason Kelce on his, most famous podcast that we have, one of the most famous podcasts in the world, the New Heights podcast, which I listen to on occasion because I think they're entertaining, interesting people. They were talking about the World Series and Travis Kelce was like, damn, that World Series was awesome. Very normal take that anyone would have. And Jason Kelce was like, what do you mean that who cares about the World Series? Why should I care about baseball? Baseball, that's why baseball sucks, because the team that spends the most money wins. Quote, so you're telling me I'm supposed to get excited about a baseball team and a team that just spends more money than everybody else? That's why baseball sucks. You just buy World Series championships. It's the dumbest thing in the world. So this is bad for obvious reasons, but also it does make you pause and it's like, is there a fan that's like, this is what they're taking away from this no matter what? The very easy thing to say about this is that clearly he did not watch, which is fine.
No
he
way.
Was in the minority, but clearly he didn't watch, which is whatever. Because again, I don't know how you could be a sports fan and watch Game 7 and just be like, man, this sucks.
Yeah.
But I guess Jason Kelce did that. And Travis Kelce tried to talk some sense into him. He tried to be like, no, but it was unexpected how they won, Miguel Rojas. And that's why Jason Kelce, it wasn't unexpected. They're the Dodgers. Of course they won. Easy to make points. I feel like football has had far more expected champions than baseball over the last 10 years, including famously
you guys,
both the Eagles and the Chiefs. So, should I care this much about this? Not really.
No.
I guess it's just one of those things where it's more disappointing when it's like, oh, I like Jason Kelce. But now it's like, I like him a little bit less. So anyway, bad.
But I like Travis Kelce more. Right. Travis Kelce, who's always been a ball knower, who's for tweeted sure. about Justin sure. Masterson. You know, he we has. Respect. That's we are Team Travis on this pod. Sure. There's Absolutely. No doubt about that. All right.
But it's bad.
Let's
it's
get
bad.
Into my UGLA. I'm just going to read this headline from the New York Times. Okay.
Okay.
Who's selling the $10 million gold toilet? Signs point to the Mets owner.
Wait. So he has a $10 million toilet?
The billionaire Steve Cohen is reported to have purchased the 18-carat flushable sculpture by Maurizio Catalan in 2017. It is now coming up for sale at Sotheby's. Okay? $10 million solid gold dumper. You think Cal Raleigh's got a big dumper? Well, this thing's...
Now...
This is a
expensive, is it actually
the
flushable?
Expensive dumper.
Is it is actually flushable?
You just need a you just need a plumber to hook it up for you.
Okay.
Steve Cohen reportedly, according to the Nueva York Times, purchased the sculpture for $10 million. Purchased this for an undisclosed amount in around 2017 from an art gallery.
But now it's auctioned.
Now it's being auctioned with the bidding starting at $10 million. Okay. Here are incredible. Selling this toilet coming off of what you could only describe as a golden toilet of a season for the New York Mets. Perfect. You could do jokes about.
I got one. Yeah.
There's a lot of money in flushing.
Oh, man. That's great. Speaking of flushable, that's good. Okay. You want to keep going? I got one more and then we'll.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Hey, you got to pay for Frankie Montas somehow, right? You know.
Well, that's the thing is that obviously Steve Cohen is doing okay financially, but this toilet will sell this week or next, whenever it's up for auction at Sotheby's. It will sell for somewhere in the $15 million range, probably. And at some point this offseason, the Mets will pay someone around the same amount of money. And when it happens, we'll be like, man, you know, Devin Williams got the gold toilet money. And that will be awesome. It will be awesome forever. I want to give a special shout out to my mom who sent me this article. It made my day. There's so much here. Steve Cohen selling a $10 million gold toilet. Great, great job. It's great. This is no notes.
As ugly as it gets. Thank you for sharing. My ugly is simple, and then we will say goodbye. It is just two things involving the Dominican Winter League, which I am now, you know, obviously all the way into because baseball never sleeps. The two best things about it is that the best thing about the Winter League is that it's every team thinks they're going to win the championship. And so when they're bad, they immediately panic. Lisay has already fired their, I think, multiple coaches, including and also released their closer, who's been their closer for the last 15 years. So that is amazing.
It's like releasing Mariano Rivera.
Literally. They're just like, no, we can't do this anymore. So love that for Lisay. And then also, I know you hate this, but the ball appears to be completely juiced as the home run rate has doubled. Doubled!
I love that.
Just like up 10%.
They needed that.
Home run rate has doubled in Lidom this year. And so that is something to monitor as Miguel Sano comes for the single season Lidom home run record. So we'll keep an eye on that as the winter rolls on. But for now, we say goodbye. Thank you, Jake Mintz. Thank you, Andrew Hartz. Thank you, Ingrid Rosas, for producing. Thank you, Ben Nicholson-Smith, for joining this episode of Baseball Rubbercast to talk about the Blue Jays. We hope everyone has a wonderful weekend. We will be back next Tuesday to talk about some awards. So everyone, enjoy your weekend. Email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com, and we will talk to you very soon. Bye.